Session number 4748, reel number 2.
Mr. Penn, reel 2.
While we're in Changi, we had various visits from high-ranking Japanese generals, etc., who made wonderful speeches about all how naughty we were and how wonderful the Japanese were, and in general a lot of bull. But then parties were taken off to various parts of the island to do work, such as cleaning up after the bombing and various things down in Singapore itself. I went off to a place near Bukit Timah, where actually the surrender took place in the Ford Works at Bukit Timah. There we were made to remove the top of a hill, and this was done by carrying earth in small baskets. The object of the exercise was to make a memorial on the top of the hill to the Japanese who were killed during the war. This was carried out. We were in a camp fairly nearby, and of a morning we had to march down to this camp, and there were we used to find graves of the dead beside the roads, and the idea is that they put food for beside the graves for the other world. And I must say that after a gang of prisoners of war marched past these graves, the graves looked rather depleted from the food angle, because we were already getting short of food there. Other things, well, there were some very, very friendly natives who used to be walking down the road with their wares, their food and various things that they were going to sell in the tent, on the trays on their head, sort of business. And by some clever manoeuvre, they found themselves in the middle of the ranks of the prisoners of war. And by the time they got to the end of the column, their trays were empty, and these were obviously acts done intentionally for our benefit. And they were very well received, these little gestures, which when you've been on a retreating army and then a capitulated army, one is not in the very highest of spirits, particularly not knowing the nature of your enemy all the time, because we were always given to understand that the Japanese didn't take prisoners of war. They shot them.
Were these Malays or Chinese who were helping you?
Well, once again, mainly Chinese, I think. The just one of those things. We didn't know what our fate would be, but I think the thing that saved us really from being killed were the vast numbers which they'd captured. They sort of got so many. They most likely had better use for their ammunition at capturing other parts of the world rather than shooting up or killing the prisoners. But that is, I think, our only saviour. Having not finished in the middle of doing that work on top of the hill, I unfortunately got hold of some tropical troubles which were beginning to come abundant through lack of food and excess sweating, as you might say, and I had some ringworm and some very nasty rashes and things in rather delicate places. And I was returned to Changi for a little treatment that could be done. My ringworm was cured by scraping the shin of my leg with a table knife, but it did get rid of the poison, etc., and healed, thank goodness. We were then told that we were going to be moved to a holiday camp in Thailand.
This is how the Japanese described it, was it?
Yes. And parties of us were taken up by train to, well, I think I have to call it Siam then it was, but we know it now as Thailand, and that's the same place. I was on the second party going up. We were travelled in metal rubber trucks. When I say rubber trucks, the trucks they use for carrying the latex. and there were 34 of us, or 34 to 40 in each of these small railway trucks crammed in there. And if we wanted sanitation, we just had to stick the appropriate portion out of the side of the truck. We had guards, one guard in each truck, one Japanese guard in each of these trucks, and he, of course, chose the best position right beside the door. In Malaya, the weather was very, very hot, and it was sitting in them during daytime. It was just like an oven, and at night it got very cold. With the metal sides of the trucks, one got very, very cold. It wasn't very nice at all. We stopped at various places on the way up, where we were given some sort of food, mainly rice and a little bit of vegetable water or something like that, just to keep us going. But I do remember that when we were allowed out, wherever possible, we used to see the chaps shaving and keeping themselves smart and keeping their morale up in those things, and that was an absolute thrilled to see that going on. And it was that I think all during our POW existence stood us in great stead, because we were not going to let ourselves be downtrodden. And it's a thing that the Japanese could never understand, and they are very affected by loss of face, and they think we should have been, but they thought we should have been, but we always kept our pride and spirit going, and I think that's really what annoyed them, really.
Was there any tendency in this period after the fall of Singapore for the troops to look for scapegoats or people to blame for the military setback that had occurred?
That is a very leading question. Now, I would be a liar if I said no, but when one is not fully aware of all the facts of what led up to the, well, I've read things off since, quite frankly, there was a certain amount of feeling that we had been, and particularly the 18th Division, which really was transferred from the going to the Middle East to Malaya just to be in time to be taken, all of them, prisoner of war. They were just sort of handed over carte blanche, more or less, without a, at least I did have my money's worth and came all the way, retreated all the way back, when a lot of those didn't have a chance to fight. And quite another thing is, absolutely stupidly, the vehicles that were with the 18th Division were all camouflaged, suitable for sand warfare. Yellow. So they came out to Malaya, which is a dark green, and the vehicles just showed up in the jungle or wherever it was, or in the rubber plantation, just like a... These things hadn't been thought of. And, of course, the big thing was, and the most degrading thing of the whole thing was, the lack of air support. We had no air support at all. The Japs had air superiority right the way through. And that, to fight a jungle war without any air support of any quality, and with a air force, the zero naught fighters, and who don't care a damn whether they're killed, as long as they do it for the emperor and the spirit of Bushido, that's all that matters with the Japanese and their fighting habits.
So who did the Japs tend to blame?
Well, naturally, the powers in be who were conducting the warfare and the policies back in the mother country, I suppose.
Was this the political powers or the military powers, or was it not specific?
Well, both, quite frankly, but the military powers were governed, I would say, by the... by the political powers, who were governed by the preparedness that we were for such events. I mean, we, quite frankly, and I must be perfectly honest here, that we were miles and miles and miles away from her home shores. And the powers that be had their time well occupied with what was going on in the European zone of warfare. So it's only natural, I would have thought, and in all fairness, I must say this, that, well, they had to look after the home front, which was as much as anything there. This air, I did mention this air superiority. Look at the way those battleships were sunk, because the aircraft carrier that was meant to go out to be their supporting vehicle and carry the vessel and carry the aircraft to defend them in their actions, etc., etc., that broke down and we never went out with them. There were those two battleships sunk, just like that, thrown away with all those men on board. That was another thing with that lack of air support.
You said that the attempts of the Allied troops to keep up their morale annoyed the Japanese. Mm. How did this show itself? How did Japanese annoyance show itself?
Well, they just got irritated. They used to make express their some of them, who one or two of them could speak a little English in some pidgin language, or were made it very clear to us that we were of no use to our army. We should be disgraced, and one of things like that. Now, as a sideline, just to put something on the record, I'd just like to mention that the Japanese army is a very different army to our army. Their discipline is very different. If we'd been naughty boys, we were made to do jankers, as it was called, of running round a drill square with bricks in your packs and things like that. But not the Japanese army. The sergeant would give or the NCO or officer would give the troop a jolly good beating up with his fist or his rifle or something like that. And the other thing is that to be taken a prisoner of war in the Japanese army is an utter disgrace. To be wounded is also a disgrace. And there, as we found in the later years of our captivity, when the our own troops were coming down through Burma and beating the Japanese back, pressing the Japanese, the sick and the wounded were not helped at all by their fellow men. There were no ambulance trains or first aid and things. They had to make their way back the best they could without any food or anything. But if the Japs had been killed in warfare, then they were heroes, and their remains were brought back with full honours in little boxes, white boxes, and they were given everything because they had died for their country. But you see, it's a different code of life, which makes a lot of it east and west.
You said earlier that the Japanese officers had told you what a bad lot you were. Mm. What did you mean by
that? Well, I mean, in being captured and what we've done what had been done in the Far East by the British, et cetera, and that they were going to start up the Far East prosperity sphere and various things and set a new code of life right through the Far East for everybody, and it was going to be utopia.
So they were saying that the British imperial record in the Far East was a black one, were they?
Inferring it, yes.
Can you tell me what happened next?
Next week, when we got up to, after this 4-day train journey, we arrived at a place called Bang Pong, where we were taken out of our trucks and marched through the little village, where we saw different sort of, we began to get the different idea we were then in Siam, or Thailand, and we saw a different sort of type of person, different category of person, people who hadn't really had much to do with the actual fighting of the war, because the Thais or Siamese were not, they were given access through their country for the Japanese to come down through it. They didn't like, this was one advantage we had all the way through, they were not too enamored with the Japanese at all. On the other hand, they were, because the Japanese had run right through their country, and on the other hand, they, as a matter of carrying on their existence and their livelihood as much as they could. So these people were quite, we were quite unique to them. We were then taken to a small camp just on the outskirts of Bangpong, where we had our first experience of a new type, well, the type of hut or that we were going to live in. It was made of bamboo with, and the roofing and sides were made of dried leaves formed into sort of a tile-shaped thing, which was called atap. And there were these atap huts, and the bed racks were split bamboos on there, which were very, very hard, very, very uncomfortable, very sharp as well, because bamboo cuts you, and the great thing was not to be cut or dug by any of these things, because tropical sores soon were started, and they got ulcerated, and very little medical supplies, and then that led to all the trouble and the amputees, etc., etc. While we were there, we also incurred a terrible heavy monsoon rainfalls were there, and luckily enough we were raised a little bit off the ground because the huts became afloat, and it was in such a cramped area that the latrines, which were just holes in the ground, and you couldn't dig very deep because of the water level, because you were surrounded by paddy fields all the time, and next thing you found going all around your feet was all the excreta, etc., etc., which wasn't a very good example of a holiday camp, which we were told we were going to. The idea of going to this camp, we were moved on to another village called Nonpladuk, where we had to build a large camp, large POW camp, where other masses were coming up from Malaya, and it transpired that the idea was to build a railway joining the main Bangkok-Singapore railway line up into Burma, for their advance into Burma, the Japanese advance into Burma. This camp, we built the camp, and we had to learn, we had to find out the easiest way was to do it with your own senses, because if not, the Japanese got very excited if you didn't do things correctly and started hitting you and causing a lot of unpleasantness. And we then built this camp, and more and more, week by week, more and more POWs were transferred up. We then built large sidings nearby, which obviously, having a prisoner of war camp and having sidings and nearby and store sheds, etc., etc., was not a good thing, because, after all, they were targets. And we did have rotten experiences of that in the latter years. Now, as this camp built up, so the supplies, other prisoners of war from other areas, were sending up railway lines, bridges, sleepers, and all different railway, which they'd stolen from various parts of their captive countries. One Malayan railway line was taken right up, and then as the Japanese captured Java, so materials coming from Java came up, and then the rolling stock, and then these parties, other parties that came through our camp for a while, and then they were moved up on rail laying parties right up, and jungle cutting and quarrying and all things right up through on the way to Burma, on the railway which was built, and following a river up the river Kwai Noi. There was never a river called the Kwai, which has been so much has been heard about, but it was the Kwai Noi, and there was a famous bridge built bridge on the River Kwai, as it was called, but that really, a bridge was built. In fact, two or three bridges were built, and wooden one first, and then another one with concrete piers and metal structures, which were brought from Java. And there, that was all built by POW labour, by using very no cranes, ropes and things, and just pure sweat and toil. By which time the clothing was getting scarce, and most of the prisoners of war were just dressed in loincloths. Now, I would like to just transgress a little bit, if I may, to explain that from when we came up into Siam, the officers were field rank and above were separated from the majors, captains, lieutenants, all stayed with the men. And right through to practically the end, we had to keep our own discipline in the camps. But the majors and the captains and the lieutenants all just were given one pip. They were allowed to keep one pip to show that the difference, so the major's crown came down and he just had a pip. Officers were officers as such, but we knew our, and it was left to us to keep our discipline. Now, in the camps, we were guarded by Korean soldiers who were brought in by the Japanese to guard them. So we had an order of discipline. You had the Japanese officer, the Japanese NCO, the Korean private, the British officer, and then the sergeants, British sergeants and troops, and then that's the way the discipline was passed down through the camps. And it was, we were made, the officers were made to keep the discipline in the camps. Now, I could see there was a necessity to try my best, and I suppose it was the thing that kept me going. Was each day I used to take a working party out to these sidings I mentioned at Nongbuluk of some 800 men. I did it purposely because I felt that if I could try and stop some of the beatings, etc., that would be a very good thing. In no way, we had to do the work we were forced to do, and if we could do it in our own way and without the excited Japanese on our backs all the time and prevent the beatings, it would be a very good thing. Furthermore, it enabled us to do a considerable amount of sabotage, and that was our main object. In, say, we had to move oil drums, well, it was a very good idea to drop some sand in them as you easily could and do various other things. So I learned a little Japanese to try and ease the strain, and we found that if we could possibly get on with the job in our own slow, sweet way, in no way did we collaborate with the Japanese, but it was to make our miserable life less miserable as possible. We used to have to march out from our camps, and I had to give my orders in Japanese to the camp, and it was decided that they should have music as we marched out. Well, some of the chaps managed to keep one or two of their musical instruments, and those who did were forced to play for us as we marched out past the guard room, and we had to salute and give our eyes right, eyes front, and, which is Japanese, is kashiramigi, and nori is eyes front, and the tune they played each day was Colonel Bogey. Little did the Japanese know what the British Army version of the words were, but it was very appropriate for our captors, we thought, and that's why that tune has always stuck as the signature tune of the Far East Prisoner of War, or FIPO as we're now called.
What were the words?
Well, the one word is bollocks, which comes out in a very, very formidable way, and don't throw your boots at father, wait till he gets in bed and have his bollocks. the various other versions which it gave vent to our feelings, etc., in a little way. And that's the way we carried on at this camp. I did those working parties for about 600 British, and by that time we had Dutch coming up to us from the Netherlands and the Hollanders, and two, not only the colonial Hollanders and also the local Javanese. They were in our camps. And so there was another language complication which we had to overcome, and we lived together quite amicably. Some little troubles, of course, but in general, in our camps, the spirit was as good as possible. And we live to this day to a motto, to keep going, the spirit that kept us going. And I think that was the great thing that, in the pride, and as I said before, that did the esprit de corps and comradeship that kept the whole thing going.
Did you find that the different nationalities being held captive by the Japanese, like British, Dutch, Australians and so on, behave differently under captivity, or were they much the same?
Much the same in ways. I think perhaps the... Well, of course, you have the different codes of life that, that coming into... various countries, perhaps the people who'd lived in the Far East had a different sort of atmosphere to the way that we were really peacetime soldiers coming out to Malaya had. We were not used to the Far East, the heat and the temperatures, where the those from Java were used to it, and we did find, quite honestly, some difficulties, but by clever negotiation and a little bit of discipline here and there shown, we were able to tidy up the loopholes and the... For sanitation was a great problem, to be quite frank with you, in these camps, and because of keeping health. And then some of the camps, of course, further up Malaya, which luckily I didn't succumb to, had cholera and all other things when they brought up a lot of the Tamils and things to build the railway and get the line through, and there were shocking problems in those areas, which no doubt you'll hear about from other people who experienced those and are better versed in that field. As the time gone by, so we found that the railway was gradually getting more nearer completion, and they had, and then that was only after a period of time when the railway wasn't getting to the Japanese powers that be, wasn't it? And then we had a speedo in, which they called a speedo, and everybody, the sick had to be sent out to work and everything. And when I say the sick had to be sent out to work, the very, very, very sick had to be sent out to work, because normally the sick had to work. And that will. Eventually, the railway was nearing completion, and of course, at that time, the war had been going on, and equipment had come into, more equipment had become available, and Pearl Harbor had been raided, and the American appetite for war with the against the Japanese had been aroused, at long last, I would say. Because they had their flavour of it when Pearl Harbor was captured. And aircraft, and there was more closer liaison between our two countries and lease lend, etc., etc. And we became a bombing target. And so, which is only natural, I'm not saying anything about it. What damage they could do to this railway line in any possible way to save it being used as a military vehicle for transferring their troops and equipment up into Burma to fight our own forces was natural, and so our camps being beside the railway line, we had to succumb to be, when they came to bomb the sidings, etc., we were very close, and on occasions we were too close. Either the camps were too close, or perhaps the aiming wasn't quite perfect, but I have been under a camp, and I have got a picture of it, as a matter of fact, and you've got the pictures in this museum here, of the camp where I was being bombed in, and when that evening we lost 100 of our chaps.
100 killed?
Killed. And, of course, the following day, the Japanese didn't lose any time in saying, you grumble that we don't give you enough food, etc., etc., and we don't look after you. Why should we, when your own people come and kill you?
So what did you reply to that?
We replied to that we ought to have been marked with properly as a POW camp, because we were not. One thing that has to be made clear, that they were not signatories of the Geneva Convention, which is what it was all about.